Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things excellently. We're talking about book 2, chapter 13. Julian seems quite pleased with himself. I mean, look at the final line of the chapter. He was a god. He's fancying himself a god because a girl likes him. But this girl is out of his league. Not in the looks department. In the social status department. You know, and that was a very clearly defined thing in those times, in those aristocratic societies. Your rank was really quite clear, wasn't it, back then? And so this girl, who is, you know, far better born than he is, she likes him better than the other guys, and that has elevated his status in his own mind to that of those other guys. He's very pleased with himself. This podcast, by the way, is brought to you by patreon.com/thehemingwaylist. You can subscribe there for as little as $1 per month, and it just, I don't know, helps to see your dollar come in appreciation of this podcast. If that makes sense. Probably not. That was one of those sentences that you start without knowing what you're about to say. Non-creative handle said, I fell behind this week on the reading due to work and finally caught back up today. My goodness, things are heating up with these two. I think it's safe to say we're on the cusp of another romantic entanglement with our young hero. This latest turn in the story led me to read the back of the book cover, which mentions something about Julian wooing Louise and Matilda. The book to this point seems to move forward only. For example, Julian left his family without return. He then left the Renals without return, then the seminary. I hope we'll see some of these older characters and stories converge. Yeah, that's true. It does just seem to progress, but without any... it's almost like the things that happened before just become insignificant as he moves to the next thing. It was good to see this Matilda thing kind of come to fruition with her, him finding out that she loves him. Because we have had a big build-up in the Matilda department. There's a good two or three chapters that were kind of just building a character there for Matilda. And you start to wonder, like, okay, we're getting a lot of this character definition. Is the author going to put this new character to good use? You know, it'd be pretty pointless if she just became insignificant to the plot or was just sort of like a, you know, another stepping stone or a prop almost, to have Julian's story continue, or is it going to be an actual character which matters? Still kind of yet to be determined. He set her up as if it was going to be another character that matters, but now it just, since the last chapter, almost just seems like another prop in the story of Julian's life, you know? So we'll keep seeing. Although, just looking ahead here and looking at the name of chapter 14, it's quite promising. Chapter 14 is called Reflections of a Young Lady. So I'd like to see some reflections from this young lady. Let's continue with the book, reading chapter 14. It starts like this. How many perplexities, how many nights passed without sleep? Good God, shall I make myself despicable? He himself will despise me, but he's going, he's leaving. Alfred de Musset. It was not without an inner struggle that Matilda had written. Whatever might have been the beginnings of her interest in Julian, such interest soon overcame the pride that had ruled unchecked in her heart ever since she had been conscious of her own existence. For the very first time, this cold, high soul was carried away by passionate feeling. But if feelings now dominated her pride, they remained faithful to the forms that pride had shaped. 2 months of struggle and new sensations renewed, so to speak, her entire moral being. Matilda believed that she could see happiness, And this vision, which is all-powerful and courageous spirits when allied to superior intelligence, had a long struggle with her sense of dignity and her ordinary feelings of duty. On one occasion, when she went to see her mother at 7 o'clock in the morning and begged her to let her take refuge at Villequier, the Marquise did not deign even to reply and advised her to go back to bed. This was her last effort at common prudence and deference to received ideas. Fear of wrongdoing and of offending things, held sacred by the likes of Calas, Deleuze, and Cruznois, had little power over her. Such people didn't seem made to understand her. She would have consulted them had it been a question of purchasing a carriage or an estate. Her real terror was lest Julian be dissatisfied with her. Perhaps he, too, has only the outward appearance of a superior man. She abhorred lack of character. This was her great objection to the handsome young men surrounding her. The more they mocked gracefully at everything which deviated from the fashion, or which, in pretending to follow it clumsily, the more diminished they became in her eyes. They were brave, and that was all. And even so, she asked herself, how do they show their bravery? In a duel, but a duel is no more than a ritual. Everything is known in advance, even down to what should to be said when one falls. Lying on the grass, one's hand placed on one's heart, there must be a magnanimous pardon for one's adversary, and a message for a beauty who is often imaginary, or who, for fear of arousing suspicion, goes to a ball on the day of one's death. A man may brave danger at the head of a squadron glittering with steel, but what a danger that is, lonely, strange, unexpected, and truly ugly. Alas, sighed Matilda to herself, it was at Henry III's court that men were to be found as great in their character as they were in their birth. Ah, if Julian had been at Jarnac or Moncontour, I would have no further doubts. In that era of vigour and prowess, Frenchmen weren't men of straw. The day of battle was often the day of least perplexity. Their life was not all wrapped around like an Egyptian mummy. In an envelope common to all and always uniform. Yes, she went on, there was more genuine courage in finding one's way back alone at 11 at night from the Hotel des Soissons, when Catherine de Medici lived there, than there is in rushing off to Algeria today. A man's existence was a succession of risks. Now, civilization has banished chance. There is no more of the unexpected. If it comes up in ideas, there aren't any epigrams to throw at it. If it comes up in action, no amount of cowardice is enough to cope with our fears. Whatever idiocy fear drives us to, it's excused. Degenerate and tedious age, what would Boniface de la Mole have said if, on raising his severed head from out of his tomb in 1793, he had seen 17 of his descendants let themselves be rounded up like sheep and guillotined 2 days later? Death was certain, but it would have been bad form to defend oneself and kill a few Jacobins. In the heroic age in France, in Boniface de Mole's time, Julian would have been the commander of a squadron and my brother a young priest of exemplary life, with wisdom in his look and moderation in his tongue. A few months previously, Matilda had despaired of meeting anyone even a little out of the common mould. She had found some pleasure in allowing herself to write to some few young men in society. This daring act, so unconventional, so rash for a girl, could have stained her reputation in the eyes of Monsieur de Croisenois, of the Duke of de Chaulnes, her maternal grandfather, and of the whole clan of the de Chaulnes, who, seeing her marriage plans disrupted, would have wanted to know the reason why. At that time, on the days she had written a letter, Matilda had not been able to sleep, yet these had only been answers. Now she was daring to say that she was in love. She was writing first, what a terrible word, and to a man on the lowest level of society. Such circumstances, if discovered, would certainly lead to eternal dishonour. Which of the women frequenting her mother's house would dare take her part? What formulas could be supplied for them to repeat in order to deaden the blow from the fearsome derision of the salons? Even to speak was appalling, but to write, there are things one does not write, cried Napoleon, on learning of the capitulation at Belen. And it was Julian who had told her of that remark, as though giving a lesson in advance. But all this counted for nothing as yet. Matilda's suffering had other causes. Oblivious of the terrible effects on society, the ineffaceable stain so saturated with scorn, for she was outraging her caste. Matilda was now involved in writing to a being of quite a different nature from men like Cruzenoir, Deleuze, or Caylus. The depth, the unknowable in Julian's nature would have frightened her even in forming a commonplace relationship with him, and now she was in the process of making him her lover, even her master. Where might his demands not reach if ever I allow him claims on me? Ah, well, I shall say with Medea, in the midst of so many dangers, myself remains to me. Julian had no reverence for nobility of birth, she believed. What was much more, he had perhaps no love for her. In these last moments of agonizing doubt, she was visited by ideas of feminine greatness. In the destiny of a girl like me, cried Matilda impatiently, everything should be distinctive, so that now the pride instilled in her from her cradle militated against her virtue. It was just then that Julian's departure precipitated everything. Happily, such characters are extremely rare. That evening, very late, Julian had the malice to send a very heavy trunk down to the porter to carry it. He called for the footman who was courting Mademoiselle de la Mole's chambermaid. This manoeuvre may have no result at all, he said to himself, but if it succeeds, she will think I have gone. He went to sleep, very cheerful, at his own joke. Matilda did not close her eyes. Next day, extremely early in the morning, Julian left the hotel without being noticed, but returned before 8. He was scarcely at the library before Mademoiselle de la Mole appeared at the doorway. He handed her his answer. He thought it his duty to speak to her. Nothing could be more appropriate, at least, but Mademoiselle de la Mole did not want to hear him, and disappeared. Julian was delighted with this. He had not known what to say. If this isn't all just a game, agreed with Comte Norbert, it is clear that the Baroque love so high-bred a girl has taken it into her head to have for me has been fired by the coldness of my looks. I'll be a little more stupid than likely if I ever let myself be carried away enough to develop a taste for this great fair-headed doll. This reasoning left him colder and more calculating than ever. In the battle that's being mounted, he went on, pride of birth will be like a high ridge constituting a military position between us. It's up there that one must manoeuvre. I've done very ill staying in Paris. If it is all nothing but a game, then the putting off of my going degrades me and exposes me. What danger would there have been in leaving? For if they are mocking me, I would have been mocking them. If her interest in me has some substance, I would have increased it 100-fold. Mademoiselle de la Mole's letter had given Julian's vanity such vivid pleasure that, taken up with laughing over what had happened, he had neglected to think seriously of the advantages of departure. It was an inherent flaw in his character to be extremely insensitive to his own feelings. He was much put out by this one, and was hardly sensitive any longer. Of the incredible victory that had preceded this minor setback, when at about 9 o'clock Mademoiselle de la Mole appeared in the library doorway, threw a letter in his direction and fled. It seems as though this is going to be a novel in letters, said he, retrieving it. The enemy makes a false step, and now I will give them coldness and virtue in return. A definite answer was demanded from him in a high tone that increased his inner satisfaction. For 2 pages on end he gave himself the pleasure of mystifying anyone who should be trying to mock him, and towards the end of his reply, for a further tease, he announced his decision to depart the following morning. This letter complete, the garden will serve for sending it, he thought, and out he went. He looked up at the window of Mademoiselle de la Mole's room. It was on the first floor next to her mother's apartment, but below was a large mezzanine. The mezzanine was so lofty that walking letter in hand in the avenue of limes beneath it, Julian could not be seen from Mademoiselle de la Mole's window. The arch made by the limes, very beautifully shaped, obscured the view. But what now? Julian exclaimed to himself. Another piece of rashness. If someone plans to make a fool of me, letting myself be seen with a letter in my hand is playing into enemy hands. Norbert's room was exactly above his sister's, and if Julian were to step out of the vault formed by the shaping of the lime branches, the Comte and his friend would be able to follow all his movements. Mademoiselle de la Mole appeared behind her window. He half showed her his letter. She nodded her head. Immediately, Julian started hurriedly back for his own room. And on the great staircase ran by chance into the beautiful Matilda, who seized the letter with perfect aplomb and laughter in her eyes. What passion there was in poor Madame de Renal's eyes, said Julian to himself. When after 6 months of intimacy she brought herself to take a letter from me, I don't believe that in her whole life she looked at me with laughter in her eyes. He did not expound the rest of his response to himself as closely. Was he perhaps ashamed of the futility of his motives? But what a difference, too, his thought continued, in the elegance of the morning gown, in the elegance of her whole demeanour. Seeing Mademoiselle de la Mole 30 feet away, a man of taste would know what rank she occupied in society. That's what one might call virtue by demonstration. Making such little jokes, Julian was still not admiring all of his thoughts to himself. Madame de Renal had had no Marquise de Crusnoy to sacrifice to him. He had had for a rival only that ignoble sub-prefect, Monsieur Charcot, who got himself called Moiron because there were no more Moirons. At 5 o'clock, Julian received a third letter. It was thrown at him through the library door. Again, Mademoiselle de la Mole fled. What a mania for writing, he said, laughing, when one might so easily talk. The enemy wishes to have my letters. That's obvious, and lots of them. He was in no hurry to open this last, yet more elegant phrases, thought he, but as he read, he went pale. There were 8 lines only. I need to talk to you. I must talk to you this evening, after midnight, on the stroke of 1, be in the garden. Take the gardener's long ladder beside the well, put it up to my window, and climb into my room. There's a moon. That doesn't matter. Alright, there we go. Another chapter down. There's a moon, and that doesn't matter. Have your say about this one over on the subreddit. Thank you very much for hanging out, and I'll see you tomorrow.